Hello and welcome to Season 13, Episode 16 of the Ubuntu Podcast. In this episode, we're going to be discussing Linux desktop aspiration. We're going to have some command line love, and we're going to go over your feedback. And joining me this week is Martin.
Hello, best friend. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you, best friend forever. And Alan is back again.
Hello.
Alan, what have you been up to recently?
I reinstalled my laptop. I had a problem, and
What sort of a problem was that? Was that not a recoverable problem?
It was a I don't have time for this unrecoverable kind of problem. I can't be bothered to fix this. You know how there's this, you know, I'll just nuke it and start all over again option, mm-hmm. or you hack and slash and fight your way through the demons of, you know, the boot system and the file system, and then eventually you get through to whatever the boss level is and you kill the boss. And I'm milking this gaming metaphor a little bit too much, but I had a problem with the experimental ZFS install that I had, and I think it's because my install was done before release, mm-hmm. and there was a bug that was fixed in the interim that didn't get applied. So it's partly my own fault. Well, it's entirely my own fault. But there was a bug and it caused some file system to fill up and I couldn't be bothered to figure out what the solution was. So I knew that I had backups, and so I just nuked it and started all over again and did a clean install this time. Without ZFS, although I could have, but I decided not to on this occasion.
So how's Ubuntu Mate 2004 working out for you?
So I don't know, because I'm using proper Ubuntu.
Oh, I'm wounded.
I don't know why. You're the director of desktop for Ubuntu as well.
I know. I wear both sets of armor now. It's fine.
And it was interesting because I didn't install everything. I often, if I do a reinstall, and I say often, I reinstall every like 2 or 3 years, if that. I didn't reinstall everything. I cherry-picked stuff as and when I needed it.
So did you do a minimal install then and just install the apps you needed?
Yeah, basically. I did a minimal install. Not minimal as in like command line and work your way up,
yeah.
but the minimal desktop install. So I didn't have lots of applications installed. But then I only added applications as I needed them. So I had to do a Zoom call. So I installed Zoom on that day. You know, I didn't preemptively install it. A few things I did because I knew I would need them, but most of it I've just slowly built up, and I've got tons of disk space now because there's loads of applications I don't have installed. So yeah, it's going all right.
Great. Let's get on with the show.
So I mentioned last week Apple's WWDC event where they talked about their conversion from x86 to ARM. And something else struck me. Every time I watch these developer conferences, I see the breadth of what Apple are developing and the depth of APIs that they have for all of the supported devices, whether it's like phones, tablets, watches, desktop. And it always makes me think, are we ever going to get to the point where we're competing with Apple? Are we ever going to get to the point where you could say we have as rich an experience as a developer making apps for Apple platforms?
So one thing that this put me in mind of was when KDE 4 launched. So KDE 4 was quite a big overhaul of the you know, not just the desktop, but the underlying all of the APIs that underpinned the KDE suite of apps, because KDE isn't just the Plasma desktop, it's a whole big suite of apps which use the Qt toolkit and various KDE APIs and the desktop bus for communicating between apps as well. And when KDE 4 launched, there was a whole load of these APIs and subsystems which launched at the same time, which were supposed to create this lovely unified experience. it worked reasonably well, but there was some fairly major gaps, which, at the 4.0 stage, which took a few releases to get out. But there was definitely something a bit like this going on then. I'm not sure if I've seen anything like it again, though.
I think we have. I think we've seen it three times. We saw it when Unity was first introduced and GNOME 3 was first introduced. And then a little later on when Unity 8 was in development. And I think part of the problem is that it took an awful lot of work on the part of Unity and GNOME Shell to effectively convince the community that these new directions that they were heading in were the right way to be headed. And there was a lot of the community that simply didn't want and resisted, you know, that move into the future, in air quotes. And we saw the same thing with Unity 8. You know, we really struggled to sort of get, you know, people to buy into this idea to go in a new direction.
So is the difference then that the Apple community don't have a choice? Apple just say, this is the way it's going to be. And everyone says, okay. But in our community, people can say, nah, I don't like that. I'll go somewhere else.
I think that's part of it for sure. But the other part is we are a disparate load of companies and individual developers. And if an individual developer says, I don't want to port my application to Wayland, or I don't want to update to KDE Frameworks 5 because I believe my application is feature complete and I'm done working on it, I don't want to do that. If you aren't motivating them, like with a salary or thousands or millions of users, then it's very hard to push a volunteer developer to move forward.
Yeah, certainly. You know, when you look at Windows and Apple, they dictate what the platform is. Now, there is some legacy in both of those platforms, but they get to define it. And if you're a developer targeting those platforms, you have to follow their direction and plans. Whereas in the Linux desktop community, there are 31 different desktop environments and window managers and what have you. There are half a dozen different toolkits and frameworks. If you don't like or don't buy into the direction of any given toolkit or framework, you can move somewhere else, either as a user or as a developer. So it's very difficult to sort of get the whole ecosystem to move together.
Yeah, but I think Mark was on the nose that KDE have probably had the best go at this. They've got the richest set of APIs on the desktop, the richest app ecosystem, I think. I don't think anyone else, like the only others I can think of is GNOME and Elementary. And really, KDE, having been around for such a long time and being a very friendly, welcoming and open community, they have that wealth of applications. Now, you could argue whether they're good or not, and you could argue whether they're beautiful or not, and you could argue probably that there are missing APIs and missing pieces here and there. And I'm not trying to put KDE on a par with Apple at all, but I think it's our best attempt so far.
Yeah, I mean, they've definitely made a good fist of it for sure, as have Elementary. Now, in addition to some people choosing not to move to the newer stuff, you also have the situation in sort of desktop Linux where people volunteer their time, not always, but in a large, you know, percentage of the time, developers are working voluntarily. And it may not be resistance. It may just be they don't have the time to uplift their application to whatever the new API framework or toolkit is. So then it starts to sort of, you know, bit rot. And then it becomes an even harder job over time to uplift that application and bring it up to current standards.
Right. And there's plenty of examples of that. Like, take, for example, it's not a great example, I'll grant you. Shutter, which is a popular screen capture tool. It's written in Perl and it uses GTK 2. And I think there was always a long-standing motivation from the developer to bring it up to GTK 3 and improve the code base. But I just don't think they've had time. And It's a small team, may even be a single person working on it. And you're right, those projects won't get uplifted, especially as there's little motivation to do it. Whereas if you look at a developer who's creating an application for the Mac, it almost certainly will be either paid for, you know, someone's paying for the application in the Mac App Store, or there'll be in-app purchases or some way for the developer to get recompensed for their time. And if they've got enough of those users, then that's a motivator for them to keep the thing moving forward, because it might break in a new version of macOS, or Apple might decide to completely switch processor architecture, in which case they have to rebuild their application. And, you know, there are all these things where you have to keep, it's a full-time job, right? It's a job for life to keep these things updated. The same thing happens on mobile platforms as well. Whereas because we're traditionally in the Linux world, we always strive for a bit of backwards compatibility if we can get it. We're nowhere near the Windows level of backward compatibility where you can run super old Windows code on brand new Windows. Mm-hmm. But we try. And so long as you've got the right libraries compiled and kicking around, you can run any old thing on a really modern Linux system.
Mm-hmm.
But it's the motivator that, like, if you're not being paid to do it, often there's no motivation for you to do it, like you said.
Yeah.
And that is certainly a factor for sure.
So I would ask, what is it you think is falling behind in desktop Linux? You know, if you see the momentum of Apple as being trailblazing, what is it that you see as lacking as a result of not that pace of change and evolution in the desktop Linux ecosystem?
So the one thing that Elementary, or one of the things that Elementary have got right, is that consistency across their applications. And we certainly don't have that. That's one thing that we just don't have in every application across the Linux landscape, because, like you said, there's, you know, 20 different desktops and a bunch of different toolkits and tons of different languages. I'm finding it hard to come up with a good concrete example, but the one that I would say is when you see things like the integration between devices and the desktop.
Mm-hmm.
Because Apple make the desktop OS, the platform, and the mobile OS and the platform, sharing files between a phone and a desktop, and even sharing your progress playing a video or sharing your progress listening to a podcast is pretty seamless between those devices. Now, we have stuff like KDE Connect and GS Connect that can do some of the rudimentary sharing of stuff between different devices. But the Apple stuff is on a completely different level of devices being shared. Like, even I think I saw an example where your headphones are connected to your phone, your Bluetooth on your phone. And if you put your phone down and start typing on the keyboard, the audio can move to your desktop. So, like, that seamless integration between these different devices is something I think we won't have because we don't have the control that they have.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, that is the big appeal of the Apple ecosystem, I think, is exactly what you've just described. And I kind of envy that, because my mobile devices never meet my desktop experience ever. Mm-hmm. They're all islands, you know. I just don't have any kind of integration. And you mentioned some of the ways I could achieve some level of integration, but that kind of integration that is offered by KDE Connect doesn't interest me personally. The kind of integration that I would be interested in is the fact that I was partway through working on something on my phone, and then I go to my desktop and there it is in the same state, you know, that sort of thing.
Yeah, I'm not saying the phone integration is a thing everyone should strive for. It was just an example of how you can see that Apple have that thing nailed. There's plenty of other things that they do, and the richness of APIs that developers get access to, and the tools that they have access to, like Xcode. These tools are, you know, full of documentation, full of examples. You know, the developer experience for creating applications there, some would argue, is unrivaled.
I think that's fair.
Now, the flip side is we're servicing a completely different audience.
Yes.
Of people who actually don't want that. You know, there are people who actually actively push back against companies like Microsoft and Apple and want an alternative, and we're providing something for them. How many of those people are there? And is it sustainable? And can we get them to buy stuff in order to continue to sustain this thing with paid app stores? I don't know. But it feels like that's our niche, and that always will be our niche.
So I think we have another niche now that Apple are not servicing. That is a commercial group of people who we are uniquely positioned to offer something to. And it does tie into Apple's recent announcement to move to ARM architecture devices, but more so the fact that for the last 5 years, Apple haven't released a device with NVIDIA GPUs in them. And what I'm getting at there is CUDA has kind of won the ecosystem war for AIML. So if you are a developer today working on contemporary stuff, AIML features somewhere in your organization's either present or future, and you simply can't do that kind of work on Apple workstations right now. And what we're seeing is the big growth area for Ubuntu desktop users buying tier one OEM devices from Dell, HP, and Lenovo that are kitted out with NVIDIA GPUs are those developers that are interested in AIML, because you get the best developer experience to create those models on your workstation and then lift that and deploy it to the cloud where those models will run at scale.
Hmm. Okay. But that's still a niche. That's still, I mean, it's a different niche than the refuseniks who don't like Apple and the refuseniks who don't like Microsoft, but it's, and maybe that's all we'll ever be. We'll be a bunch of weird niches.
Yeah. I think that it may be unfair to call the AIML development community a niche. It certainly was, but it's growing so fast. It's becoming such a big audience that the tier one OEMs are prepared to invest in Ubuntu on laptops and workstations more and more in order to target that community of developers.
Surely all Apple would have to do is ship a machine with an NVIDIA based GPU and they're in the game again.
They could well be, for sure. But, you know, I think there are political reasons why it's not just ship a device with an NVIDIA GPU.
Yeah. I'm interested to know what our listeners think. Are we always destined to be in these niches? Some larger than others, but I still maintain these are niches. Or what do our listeners think of? Is there a ceiling on where we get to with the Linux desktop? Is it always going to be below, you know, whatever million machines, which sounds like a lot, but, you know, proportionally is what a percentage point in the grand scheme of things. I'm interested to know what people think would take us to the next level.
And if you want to let us know what you think, you can email show@ubuntupodcast.org.
If you love the command line as much as we do, send us a command that will blow our minds, and we might even mention it on the show. Send your command line love to show@ubuntupodcast.org.
And now it's time for some command line love.
Oh, I haven't missed that.
So this week's command line love is provided by Mr. Martin Wimpress.
Yes. So my command line love this week is Bashtop. And Bashtop, as you may tell from the name, is a top-like command line utility implemented in Bash. But oh my goodness, it is pretty.
So this is for monitoring what's running on your computer at the moment.
So it tells you, hang on, I'm just going to have to go up to a different virtual screen. It tells you your CPU utilization and temperatures. It tells you your memory utilization and where it's used, your disk utilization, the processors that are currently consuming the most amount of resources and your network bandwidth. And these are all interesting things, but it looks so nice. I have it permanently running in a drop-down terminal.
It's very colourful.
It is.
I have to say, every time I bring it up, it's like watching an open fire burning. I can't stop staring at it.
It kind of reminds me of the old Amiga demos.
Yes. I mean, it's very cleverly done as well. It's all regular characters, but it's so very cleverly put together. I mean, it's utterly convincing with spark lines and graphs, and it's 256 color, so they're all gradiated as they're presented. I mean, it's just marvelous. So as far as I'm concerned, Bash Top is the new H Top.
This looks very much like a couple of similar things that have been written in Go that I've seen over the years. And I think one of them was called Go Top or something like that. And it showed almost exactly the same kind of thing. And it did worry me running this, thinking, well, if it's written in Bash and it's trying to grub around the system and get all my CPU and memory and everything, surely it's going to consume, you know, a huge amount of CPU time to draw this thing on the screen. And it doesn't. Like, right now, while I'm talking to you, it is the second thing consuming CPU, but it's only using like 4% or something like that to draw this. And I don't have to leave it on all the time, but it is so pretty.
So there it is. We'll have instructions in the show notes how to install that. It's currently available in a PPA. And it's a simple apt install, but certainly worth checking out. Hope you like it.
And now it's time for all your wonderful feedback. And to start us off, Kevin emailed us at show@ubuntupodcast.org.
On the recent episode discussing Ubuntu being a rolling release, I felt the answer a tad dismissive of certain use cases. The answer given that snaps effectively fill a niche in order to get the latest applications is fine for GUI applications, but does not address components, libraries. We utilize several hundred Ubuntu machines at work and quite regularly run into issues where one package or another is just a few versions too old. Recently, it was systemd and libreadline, etc. It's a very good point. Yeah, that's one of the things we don't tend to snap is rando libraries or system components like systemd.
But I would say for that use case, you can create a container and put the things inside that container that you need for your application and run it there. So, you know, containerize your things and provide the libraries and versions of tools that they need.
An anonymous listener emailed us.
There is one rolling aspect I don't remember being discussed and thought I would bring it up. It has to do with the desktop environment itself. What I mean is, it'd be excellent if Ubuntu could have periodic upgrades to GNOME throughout the LTS lifecycle in a similar manner to the way hardware enablement is done. Each GNOME upgrade brings significant improvements to both the performance and user experience, and it really is a downer having to stick with an older GNOME desktop on the LTS. Maybe GNOME apps could be snapped. The general idea I have is something like KDE Neon, but for the Ubuntu desktop and at a slightly more conservative pace. That's an interesting idea. What do the two of you think of that?
Having seen how painful it is for the desktop team to rev all the various components that make up GNOME desktop and keep them up to date in one release of Ubuntu, the idea that they would update them in multiple old LTS releases feels like a ton of extra work and going completely against the whole idea of LTS, which is it's a stable platform that's not moving all the time.
As someone who doesn't care how hard you have to work, I think it sounds like a fun idea. But to be honest, the GNOME desktop experience isn't really what I care about. I care about the Ubuntu desktop experience, and just having the latest version of GNOME on the previous LTS, I don't feel like that would give a better desktop experience. I don't think you'll be able to capture all of the new things from the next that are coming forward in the next LTS and backport the whole thing and make it, you know, like you're constantly rolling on. I think that the way that the experience evolves needs the sort of you know, you actually have to go to the next release, so you've got all of the underlying stuff there.
Yeah, I do like the idea. I did have a go at doing this in the early days of Ubuntu Mate, where I created PPAs so that, you know, interested users could get to the newer versions of Mate on, you know, a stable version of the underlying OS. And just on a small project like that, it was almost unmanageable to do. Now, what the desktop team does is they do bump to the point releases of GNOME in the LTS, and we do backport like significant fixes and performance improvements that didn't appear in that release in order to improve the experience, because it's out there for such a long time. We want it to be the best it can be. But in order for it to be the best it can be, we do need this one version that we can target, maintain, and look after. And if it keeps moving, it makes it very difficult to track and triage bugs over time when versions bump and change.
Jason Armstrong emailed us a rolling rhino, which we've shared on Twitter. James Henstridge, yes, that one, emailed us.
The original name we planned for a rolling release was Grumpy Groundhog, and he's given a link to somewhere deep in the bowels of the Ubuntu wiki. He said it was big, more ambitious than packaging just the latest release of each upstream. It was going to package the tip of the main development branch of each upstream, assuming it was buildable. So the James Henstridge is someone who's worked for Canonical for a very long time. And he is the JH in JH build.
He
is. Which is one of the build tools that people use all over the place. So, yeah. Hello, James.
Skozaki emailed us.
Long-time listener, first time writing in. I would really appreciate it if you could talk about Ubuntu Landscape on-premises server, mainly how the release cycle works for this software. I have recently moved a handful of servers from CentOS, which has Red Hat's cockpit, to Ubuntu Server 2004. I was a little surprised when I went over the Landscape docs to find there isn't a supported version for 2004, even though it's an LTS. I think there is now, but certainly Landscape lags behind the release points for the LTS version of the distro.
I think they maintain a PPA that's got the latest version of Landscape in. So you can add that PPA. I'm pretty sure the documentation points to it. But maybe that's changed since the reader wrote in.
Nicholas Cordero emailed us.
I recently stumbled on Popey's GitHub repository for a snap for the Gambas development environment, and it appears at some point this was of interest. I am hoping this might be picked up again, as Gambas deserves recognition, and I think the Snap Store would be a valuable step to software development for new and aspiring creators. I think I started looking at this a while back when someone on the Snapcraft forum asked about it, and I looked at two things. One, snapping Gambas itself, and the second thing is making it easy to snap stuff that had been written using Gambas. Gambas, as I recall, is it's like a Linux version of Visual Basic. That's what it was designed to
be. This is what I was just going to ask. I was like, I have no idea what this is. What is this thing?
Right. Yeah, that's what it is. It's like Visual Basic for Linux.
Huh.
I just haven't had time to look at it again recently. Yeah, I could take another look at it. I'll add it to my to-do list of things to look at on a Friday afternoon.
Mike Dalrymple emailed us.
I just installed 2004 alongside 1804 and discovered that the PPA for Ansible doesn't have support for Focal FUSE yet. I've run into this a few times over the years with PPAs for things like Docker and VirtualBox. Can you tell me a good approach to addressing this problem? He asks, should I... 1. Set my sources to a previous release. No.
No, do not do that.
2. Find an installer deb. The answer to that is maybe, perhaps, so long as you know that deb is built to work on 2004. 3. Install from source. Yes, you could do that if you stick it in a container or what have you, if it's something that you can put in a container, unlike Docker. Or just wait. So just wait is the answer I would go with, or there is secret option number 5, which is reach out to the vendor stroke publisher of the software you want and ask them to publish a version for the current LTS release.
Yeah, just wait is the zero effort option. The slightly above zero effort option is just contact the person who maintains the PPA and ask them to bump it.
Tom van der Brink emailed us.
Following Martin's example, I've been testing my network. I have Ethernet over power from the ground floor to the attic. From there, a cable goes to the second floor where I work. I ran iPerf over a clean cable between two computers. Turned out I couldn't max it close to 1 gigabit per second that I was seeing everywhere else over cables. So I got a cable tester and it showed me the termination issue on the connector. After fixing that, all is good between the second floor and the attic. The bottleneck to internet is still the Ethernet over power connection. They're TP-Link AC1200s. Would replacing these with a newer 2000 series help enough to get close to my internet contract speed?
So, I did have the 1200 version of the TP-Link power over Ethernet adapters that Tom has currently, and I have upgraded to the 2000 models. And in my testing, now this will be different for everyone else, but in my testing, the old models did about 132 megabits per second from my office upstairs to the router downstairs, or at least a device on the router downstairs. And the AV2000 versions managed 190 megabits. So that was 60 megabits improvement, which is great, but nowhere near to getting you gigabit speeds. And in my testing, the best case that I could get with any kind of home plug device was about 260 megabits. So my answer is no, I don't think home plug is going to get you close to the gigabit speeds that you're aspiring to.
Callum emailed ThinkPad Corner.
Hi guys, brilliant show. Just thought I'd email in and say I'm well and truly a convert to the ThinkPad Corner. I have an X230 with a 2.9 GHz i5 that absolutely flies. I've even just paid for a spare machine to harvest the display from to replace my damaged one and to have spare parts to keep my machine alive for years to come.
Awesome. X230 is a really good model to pick. They're abundant on eBay and they're able to run modern desktop environments perfectly fine.
Do you have an X230 in your collection?
I don't have an X220, but I'm on the lookout for a 230.
Why is it better than the 220?
It's the next generation of CPU.
Ah.
The only downside is it's got the newer chiclet keyboard. The 220 is the last generation that had the older style ThinkPad keyboard, which is one of the reasons why I keep my 220.
And Amelith also emailed ThinkPad Corner.
How would one get into ThinkPads? I hear so many people saying how wonderful they are, that they're incredibly configurable. You can swap out this part or that, and I just have no idea where to begin. I have a beast of a desktop, and I'm looking for something cheap and light to use at uni. I would go with a Pinebook Pro, but I've heard someone say that ThinkPads get better performance for the same price, which is quite compelling. So, I would say for uni work, if it's typing documents and stuff like that, you know, keeping notes in class, then anything from X230 upwards is great. X is fairly lightweight. And as I previously said, the X230 is a good place to start. If you've got a little bit more money, get a slightly newer one. One thing you're going to have to watch for is the battery life on the older ones. The batteries will just be dead by now, but you can get replacement batteries and they last okay. Another alternative is to go for a T-series. And the nice thing about a T-series is if you're in a university environment where you can't plug into the wall to charge, the T-series models, many of them, have interchangeable batteries. So you can swap the battery out while the laptop is on because it has an internal and an external battery. And that's what I do with my T450 is swap the battery. I can sit in the pub for hours and hours and just swap the batteries and never go anywhere near a mains outlet. So yeah, there's lots of options, but something like a T450 or an X230 or X250 would be great.
Yeah, and I would add to that that the website to go and look at is ThinkWiki, where they catalogue every ThinkPad that's ever been, and you can go and find. So if you're looking at eBay for ThinkPad listings, you can look at ThinkWiki and find out what the configurations are, and also when IBM or Lenovo may have said this laptop only supports 8 gigabytes of memory, but ThinkWiki will tell you actually it supports maybe 16 or 32, so you know what your upgrade options might be. So ThinkWiki is a great resource for figuring out which ThinkPad might be right for you.
And that's all of your wonderful, wonderful feedback. And that's all for episode 16. We want to say a big thank you to everyone who has contributed to our Patreon and who has given us one-off donations via PayPal to help cover our production costs. It's been amazing to see how much support we've got from people. Really blown our minds. If you would like to sound as good as we do, you can get in touch with Joe Restington at joerest.com and use his pro post-production services.